of heart. I had a change of heart. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. A change of heart, sure. Margo Price is the artist we're playing this morning for the Wild at Heart tour at the Bearsville Theater in Woodstock, New York, on the 26th of this month, which is in just 3 days. And you can find out more about that event by going to BearsvilleTheater.com, BearsvilleTheater.com, and check out the playlist posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. Okay, so some of our region is dealing with a powerful bomb cyclone. Other parts of our area are dealing with blizzardish conditions. Other parts of our area have nothing. So it's a weird weather day, and we hope all of you are safe and sound and secure and do all of the things that you know you should do just to be safe. And consequently, we have two of our panel members who are joining us by telephone this morning, which is great. And we'll welcome everybody in just a moment. It's very nice to have you here as well. So wherever you are and you want to get in on the conversation, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Because, you know, a nor'easter isn't the only thing making news. There's a lot of stuff out there that we can talk about today, and we will do just that in mere moments. The former mayor of the city of Albany, New York, Kathy Sheehan, joins us. Good morning, Kathy. How are you?
I am well. Good morning.
It's really nice to have you here. Thank you
very much. It's good to be here. I want to give a shout out to the Albany JCC, which opened on time this morning, which is the reason that I am here and not with my almost four-year-old granddaughter, who I'm sure would have had great words of wisdom had she joined us for the panel, but is probably better off ensconced at the JCC, yes, having some apple juice and a little morning sustenance.
I wish we were working on policy. but great. We love having you here, and I'm so happy that you are with us this morning. Jim Ketterer joins us as well, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, and speaking of shout-outs, I'd just like to give one to, I think they're called Capital Region Classical. They do a concert series at Union College, and I went yesterday, and they had a great duo, young cellist Sterling Elliott and a pianist Janice Carissa, and they did one piece that was written in the middle of World War One and was very dark and brooding and searching. And it's the Union Memorial Chapel where these concerts happen.
Yes.
And behind the stage is a list of all the names of the Union students who died in World War One. And it was just reminding me of the stakes, you know, the things we talk about on the radio, the things we read in the newspapers. There's real life consequences. And tomorrow is the fourth anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And the real-life consequences have real effects on real people. And I was really struck by that concert yesterday in that way. So it was a wonderful event, and they do a great job, but it was also deeply moving.
And with first of all, that's a beautiful place, but it is. Of the 28 to 30 names that are engraved on that wall. It's
right.
It's very, it's moving.
And particularly that piece of music that was written in the middle of that war. And that was a time, like our current time, where, you know, the world order was shifting. You know, the world order that existed had kept Europe relatively peaceful for all of the 1800s fell apart. And as it fell apart, we had World War One and then World War Two, and so many millions of people died and were affected.
Derek Delaney is the artistic director, and you can find out more about their incredible season by going to Capital Region Classical, CapitalRegionClassical.org. Thank you, Jim Ketterer. Let's go to our telephone providers. Libby Post joins us. political consultant, lobbyist. Hello. How are you?
Hi. How are you all doing?
We're fine. We're fine.
Oh, good.
Kathy's wondering how she made it and you didn't.
Well, part of the problem is I have another Zoom at 11 and another Zoom at 12, and I didn't want to be driving around on the streets.
I understand.
Not make it. So here you go. I was supposed to be on the road, but there you go.
Well, you know what? However we get our fix of Libby, we don't care.
As long as
we get our fix of Libby. So that's good. We welcome Mark Whitman to... Oh, and by the way, happy belated birthday to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It was lovely.
Very nice. Mark Whitman is with us as well, investment banker on Wall Street. All right. We have our group. Let's go. And we begin. So here we were, Friday morning, minding our own business, doing a panel, talking about all kinds of issues, talking about Iran, talking about other things, immigration, talking about DHS. And then the Supreme Court announced their decision regarding Trump's tariffs. And oh my goodness, the show just went into a different direction. Well, it's going to be, we're going to talk about that again this morning. So we, when last we left you on Friday morning, the court had declared that those tariffs were not proper, they were illegal, and they could not be continued. Then, very quickly, within the day, the president had a workaround and said, okay, so now we have a global tariff of 10%. And then he went to bed and I'm sure had a very restful good night's sleep. And then woke up and said, oh, I'm sorry, it's 15% now. And so this is the idea of if I can't do it this way, I'm going to do it this way. And administration officials maintain that they can replicate the sky-high duties recently invalidated by the Supreme Court, that word sky-high from the New York Times coverage. Trump aides projecting confidence on tariffs after the court loss. They say they're on track to resurrect as many of its punishing tariffs that were struck down by the court, insisting that the new approach would fulfill President Trump's trade ambitions in a more legally durable way through a new 15% global tariff that Mr. Trump announced on Saturday and a set of coming trade investigations that may result in stiff tariffs on countries in Asia. The administration looked to project confidence that the legal setback would not deter its characteristic brinkmanship on trade. All right. Mark, I think we've got you back.
Yeah, Joe, how do I sound now?
You sound amazing. So, tariffs, what do you make of it?
Well, it's a mess. I'll give you that. Let me start, Joe, with an analysis that I found interesting, and I think I found it first in the Washington Post over the weekend, just in terms of the legal side of the case. First of all, I think a lot of people were heartened that the Supreme Court finally put up a stop sign. This is probably the second one of note that it's put in front of the Trump administration. But I do think it's worth looking at the analysis that Gorsuch offered. If you look at this, this is one of the major doctrines questions that the Supreme Court has decided. Two of the other previous ones involving, if you remember, student debt forgiveness under the Biden administration. But in all four of these cases, the rulings have been identical 6-3, striking down the executive power. But there's been a stark divide over who says what, depending on the question. For Roberts, Gorsuch and Barrett, they apply the major questions doctrine consistently every time, holding that, sweeping executive action requires clear constitutional authority. Not surprisingly, in a way, Thomas, Alito, and Kavanaugh invoked that doctrine to block Biden three different times, but then abandoned it to support Trump on tariffs. And finally, Sotomayor and Kagan did the reverse in all four cases. And if you remember, Jackson effectively replaced Breyer, but Jackson basically de facto continued that pattern. Breyer voted the same way with the liberals, and now Jackson has supported the president in this one. So it's interesting to see that despite the fact you might conclude initially this is a sort of a win for the Democrats, it's actually Roberts, Gorsuch, and Barrett, along with the swing voters, depending on who the president's been, that have held that in order for the president to be designated authorities that are constitutionally those of the legislative branch, it has to be a very, very clear designation. And Gorsuch's decision even raises the specter that the court may prohibit, in some cases, the legislature from designating authorities that are in the Constitution, even if it tries to do so. So before we get to the economics, I just thought a clear-eyed look at the political and legal implications of this was interesting.
Let me get – we want to come back to you, too, and just, talk about more aspects, other aspects of this, including just how you started off your conversation of it's a mess. So I want to get to that as well. But let's go round robin here first and get comments from our entire group. Kathy Sheehan.
Well, I think that, in looking at how Trump responded and his continued efforts to undermine any other authority, be it the Supreme Court, be it Congress, from undermining that confidence and eroding that confidence, this is again another example. As we've read and even conservative commentators have noted, he's been on this dangerous slope for a long time, but he continued on that dangerous slope, again making personal attacks against the Supreme Court members, saying that their families should be ashamed of them. But, I think the financial piece of this is something that we have to get to, remembering that all of this is a grift. This is really about what is happening to the underlying tariffs and the billions of dollars that this government is using to try to keep the government funded while it gives billionaires these huge tax breaks. And so, I think that this also is very presents a huge challenge with respect to the fiscal implications of it as we look at how much the federal government has brought in with these taxes. That's what they are. They're taxes. And what is going to happen if, one estimate I heard, upwards of $100 billion has to be refunded.
Jim.
Yeah, I do want to get to the economics of the tariff issue, but Mark started off on the analysis of the decision, and he's quite right about this interesting split on the use of the major questions doctrine, which is generally a conservative way in which judges are analyzing executive legislative powers. And it's interesting to see this split on the court among the justices who are conservative. But I was really taken with an analysis that I came across by Andrew Weissman of NYU Law, who was talking about Roberts' majority opinion and the ways in which that opinion draws heavily on another landmark case that stopped a president from using the declaration of an emergency to do something that was seen as a massive overreach. And this was the 1952 Youngstown case. And when Truman was basically trying to stop a strike and take over steel production in the midst of the Korean War, and say this was because it was a war and there was an emergency, he was able to do it. And so this was struck down. And the really interesting thing that Roberts in this current case draws on from that case is not the majority opinion, but is the concurrence that was written by Justice Robert Jackson, who went to Albany Law School, by the way, and preceding this Youngstown case, had been the lead American prosecutor in Nuremberg. And in his concurrence on this case, which Roberts draws on heavily, he talks about the dangers of executives concocting emergencies and using those fake emergencies as a way to accrue more power. And in the concurrence, which I was reading this morning, it's just, by the way, it's just absolutely beautifully written. He talks about this having been done in Germany and other places. And it really resonates strongly and clearly resonated with Roberts and his team of clerks who were putting this together. And it is interspersed through the majority doctrine, the majority opinion. And so I think that this really is, this is an important moment politically, historically for us, but it's also, I think, really probably going to be looked at as a very important case in the history of the Supreme Court.
Want to hear from Libby Post as well. We're going to take a quick break and then come back and go to Libby, and then we'll address some of the other issues involved in this. And there are many, so we will talk about that. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Your letters and Libby Post when we come back right after this.
With my suitcase packed, I wipe the tears from my eyes.
Times they were tough. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, talking about President Trump and the cleanup on aisle four having to do with tariffs, and initially a 10% global tariff, now a 15% global tariff, and what this means after the court loss that was announced on Friday. Libby Post.
Well, it means that some people on the Supreme Court, some of the six that he's put in, have found their backbone and are actually trying to defend democracy, which is a lovely thing to see. And on the other hand, you know, Trump is going to continue to do his saber rattling to make it seem like he's going to win in this. You know, they could do this 15% global tariff. Okay, it's just going to cost his people, his constituents, his supporters, it's just going to cost MAGA folks more money to live. And it's not going to be this panacea in trade that he's always thought this was going to be, that everyone was going to just come and kiss the king's ring. And that's ultimately what he's looking for. A number of countries are saying, I could say it more colorfully, but I can't because we're on the radio. But a number of countries are saying, see ya, we'll do business with other people and not with the United States. Or if you want to do business with us, you need to get rid of these tariffs or whatever it is. And the map is really interesting that's in the Times because it's, you know, you've got some tariffs well, it seems that Russia's staying the same. China's going to go up or might go down. It's very, very questionable about what he's doing and where he's doing this and hurting people. So he's going to China soon to talk about trade, and oh well, don't worry about it. I'll bring down the tariff. We can do our trade agreement. He'll come home and say I'm a hero. I mean, this is what we're getting all the time, and he's putting the worst tariffs on some of our strongest allies, which makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, shifting to the financial impact of this, you know, again, I say it all the time, but it's a grift, right? So this is a president who gave trillion-dollar tax cuts to the richest people in this country, told his supporters, right, working-class Americans, that it wasn't going to cost them anything and they might save some money too. And then he started with these tariffs. And people still do not seem to appreciate the fact that these tariffs are a tax on working families, because ultimately we pay more for things because of these tariffs. And so this is how he's paying for it. And I think the inability of the Trump administration, with all of the pushback on affordability, to be able to give a concrete example of how these tariffs help an average working class family speaks volumes, because it doesn't ultimately help them. I mean, I reserve the right to get smarter, and maybe someone out there can explain it to me. But I think, again, this is about a tax that people are paying, and he's calling it a tariff and saying we're screwing all these other countries that have been screwing us, and so you should feel really good about it. And ultimately, we are the ones that pay for it.
Mark.
Well, I appreciate Mayor Sheehan's analysis. I see it a little bit differently in the following way. These tariffs never made up for the tax cut that Trump championed in the ugly bill. And so I see them as rhetorically connected, but mechanically detached. And I also, to look ahead at what I think is going to happen, I actually think this, if you look underneath the surface, there's going to be no end of machinations in courts and within the administration about how they put together Humpty Dumpty in terms of reconstructing these tariffs. They're going to use a temporary emergency power for 150 days and then leg into longer term versions of tariffs under other justifications that take a while to set up. But I think the die is cast. GDP has probably been decreased in this. Remember, by the way, tariffs only affect imports. Imports are only 15% of GDP, roughly. So despite the initial catastrophic predictions that in some part were based on fears of trade wars, which never took place, this is going to hurt, but it's not going to be a death blow. Individual households are estimated to pay about $1,000 in 2025 as a result of the tariffs. It seems that most of the costs, as most expected, were borne by U.S. consumers. Ultimately, I think it's pretty clear that basically, with his 15% levy, Trump's got to about 7/8 of where he was in terms of overall tariff rates. So again, looking beyond all the details and just at the macro picture. And I think it's clear, with all the legal delays Trump has available to him, unless a legislative branch puts its foot down really hard in a way that Trump can't veto, that's the sort of picture we're going to be looking at until Trump isn't in office anymore and somebody else cleans this up. And there's the question of the rebates of the $100 billion plus that have been taken in so far. And frankly, if you put me in charge of it, I could get it done in 2 weeks. If you allow the administration to use the courts, they can stretch this out for years. And it seems like that's the way they're going. So I think the headline picture is inflation's going to run a 0.5% hotter than it would have otherwise for probably another year. It'll be sort of spread out over the year. GDP will be depressed by about 0.5 percentage point, I would think, annually for the foreseeable future. I also think that the tumultuous nature of Trump being forced to use other mechanisms is going to further degrade his argument that he's doing anything meaningful to help American manufacturing with all this uncertainty. Anything that will take place as an offset to benefit Americans will be minor at best at a global sense. So Trump's going to waste a lot of time, a lot of economic effort. His ability to use tariffs by tweet as a threat has been largely removed. It'll be far harder for him to make credible threats in the middle of the night on Truth Social that are unconnected to trade questions. He's tried to use tariffs for everything from feeling personal slights to trying to win the peace prize. That's going to be a heck of a lot harder for him to do. This will hurt our economy. It is not by any means a death blow. It'll cost Americans, you know, $1,000 to $1,500 a year on a consistent basis in terms of increased taxes. So it's extraordinarily unfortunate, but the United States economy is currently vibrant and is powerful. So it's going to hurt, but again, it's not a death blow.
Jim.
Okay.
Yield to Libby, and then we'll go to Jim. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Libby.
It's vibrant and powerful, thank you, Jim, for those who can afford it. I don't think anybody on this radio, any of us talking right now, right, will have a problem with $1,000 to $1,500 more per year in quote-unquote taxes, which are the tariffs. We have to look at the people who are going to lose their housing, who can't pay the rent, right? We went to fruit shopping yesterday for fruit and some other stuff. It was over $100. You know, the cost of living just continues to rise. Those of us who are making a decent living, it's not going to impact us that much. But there are plenty of people in this country, including the MAGA base, who are going to feel this. They're not going to be able to pay the rent, pay the mortgage, pay health care. Then on top of it, the health care costs for those who were on the Affordable Care Act has gone through the roof. We'll see more medical bankruptcies. This is all about, like the mayor said, all about a grift, all about making Trump and his cronies richer while the rest of us are pandered to, and then many of us end up out on the street.
Jim.
Well, yeah, just to follow up on that, you know, the president has consistently failed to grasp how tariffs work. And it's a question that I always have is that he just doesn't understand with all of the economists across the political spectrum who know how tariffs actually work available to him to explain it to him. Does he just not get it? Or is he just willfully misleading the American public? Either of those is not a good answer. The reality is that
now.
Yeah, that countries do not pay the tariffs, and you know he keeps repeating this over and over and over again. But it's simply wrong. You know, Mark was talking about the amount absorbed by these tariffs, and so the New York Fed put out a report earlier this month, and they said in 2025, 94% of the new tariffs fell on U.S. businesses and consumers. Not all of it went to consumers. U.S. businesses absorbed a certain amount of it. It buried in that report also is the prediction that they would not be able to do as much anymore. And also in that report, they talk about how tariffs not only raise the price on imports, but they raise the floor on prices even for domestic versions of that. So, for instance, coffee that is imported from countries that are heavily tariffed would obviously go up because of the tariffs. The coffee from countries that are not as heavily tariffed also go up because they can and because the floor on the market has gone up. Also, the main reason that Trump has put forward on doing these tariffs is him talking about us running trade deficits. And so a report came out just last week, the trade deficit in goods has gone up in this last year. In fact, it's gone up to absolutely record levels. And so the deficit measures trade in goods and in services. And the reality is that goods and manufacturing is actually a smaller part of our economy by a lot. It's a much smaller part of our economy. And the main component of our economy is in services. And in services, in terms of international trade, we dominate the world. In fact, we are running massive trade surpluses with most countries around the world in terms of services. So should they tariff us? Are we somehow behaving wrongly? I mean, I think, of course, the economic answer to that is no. But if you were to follow the Trumpian logic, it would make sense that everybody else should be tariffing us because of our massive trade surpluses in services. So it just doesn't make any economic sense. The thing that he says he's trying to solve has not only not been solved, it's gotten worse. There's no movement to kind of, you know, reestablishing kind of a 1930s, 40s, 50s manufacturing base in this country. That's not happening, and that's still just not a key part of the economy anymore. So we're working in a world where we have somebody who is in charge of our country and in charge of these major decisions and is simply stirring the pot with one piece of misinformation after another.
Well, and I think it is detracting from what people really need to be talking about. And Libby hit on part of it, the shell shock you get when you walk into the grocery store and see how much things cost, the shock that you get when you open your utility bill. This is a president who promised when he was campaigning that he was going to get our energy prices down by 50%. Electric rates are through the roof in our area. The price of natural gas rose over 10%. Those numbers are only moving higher and higher as we have these huge data centers coming online, using a lot of electricity, which we then pay for. And as this administration crushes the renewable energy industry and is working really hard to reduce the amount of electric generation from renewable sources, we're going to instead burn coal and, you know, spew mercury into the air. And so, you know, this does detract from him having to answer to the campaign promises that he made and the lived reality of working families day in and day out. You might pay a little bit less for gas at the pump, but that does not even begin to make up for how much more we are paying for things like utilities, like daycare, you know, like food. These are real costs that real Americans have to pay. And adding to that, $1,000 to $1,500 caused by these tariffs seems kind of esoteric, right? How do you drill that down and make that something that is something that somebody can concretely look at and associate that tariff with them paying more? And so I'm sure he would rather be talking about that and talking about tariffs than talking about what's happening for most American families, which is that we're continuing to feel incredible economic pressure.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss on this. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after the short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Mark Whitman, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Kathy Sheehan make up our group this morning. As I mentioned, we have quite a few listener letters, and I'll get to those probably after the top of the hour break. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. I did want to just spend a moment on the editorial board opinion and outlook that was written in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend on Friday afternoon. And Mark sent this to me, and it really is a great read, and you can find it online. But I'm just going to read a couple portions of it. But President Trump owes the Supreme Court an apology to the individual justices he smeared on Friday and the institution itself. Mr. Trump doubtless won't offer one, but his rant in response to his tariff defeat at the court was arguably the worst moment of his presidency. Granted, Mr. Trump is angry that the court voted 63 to overturn his signature, quote, emergency tariff policy. Other presidents have criticized the court when they didn't like a ruling, but Mr. Trump lit into the justices who voted against him as traitors bought by foreign interests. The Supreme Court's ruling on tariffs is deeply disappointing, and I'm ashamed of certain members of the court, absolutely ashamed for not having the courage to do what's right for our country. He later called liberals a disgrace to our nation, but he heaped particular vitriol on the three conservatives. The Wall Street Journal goes on to say this is ugly even by Mr. Trump's standards. He's accusing them of betraying the U.S. at the behest of nefarious interests he didn't identify, no doubt because they don't exist. Asked about Justices Gorsuch and Barrett, whom he appointed, Mr. Trump called them an embarrassment to their families. Mark, you sent this. I'm interested in your thoughts and what raised a flag for you to want to discuss this.
Yeah, Joe, I got to be careful in how I express this, but I love this for what it revealed both about Trump and frankly about the Wall Street Journal. First of all, Trump gets the fundamental legal analysis around Barrett, Gorsuch, and Roberts wrong. They've been consistent on the major questions doctrine. So to take it personal, you have to really work hard, but that doesn't require much for Trump. It was interesting to me that the editorial board called this the worst moment of Donald Trump's presidency. Apparently, the Wall Street Journal thinks this is worse than the months of racism, xenophobia, and misogyny that Trump has spewed. I thought it incredible that they were more offended on behalf of the justices who have security details than other Americans and other people in our world.
I thought January 6th may come in. I thought January 6th may make mm-hmm. that list at the top, but
yeah, right. We at the Journal are really offended at who you attacked. This is the worst moment. I'm a little confused why they picked defending the Supreme Court as their top priority. But further, the editorial says that Trump is demeaning himself. They never mention the office of the presidency. So I think for the Wall Street Journal, even that ship has long sailed on Trump's behalf. It also interests me that the board warned of a risk of violence against the justices, but that the opinion board quickly preserved its own bona fides by trying to draw a parallel to Schumer's comments in 2020 around Kavanaugh. So they have to go back 6 years into somebody who doesn't have the blowhorn that the president does in order to sort of make sure that we understand that even though they're criticizing the president, they're still conservative. I just thought the piece was telling in terms of the journal's criticism of Trump, but I thought it was almost just as telling as where the opinion board sits in terms of its worldviews.
Whenever President Trump behaves in this way, whether it's in reaction to the Supreme Court, still fresh in my mind is the long, rambling, grievance-filled speech at Davos, all the Truth Social insanity, the posting of many multiple things in the middle of the night, all of these things. It's also a reminder to me that this is the person who has sole authority. And by sole authority, I really mean it. People, I think, often lose the fact, the thread, that this is the person who has sole authority over our nuclear weapons. He has the codes with him. And it used to be for many, many decades, Republicans would pound the table and say character matters, temperament matters. And I do agree with that. I think it does matter. And I think it matters when you have someone in a position of such great trust, authority, and dealing with the very most sensitive possible things in the world. And this is somebody who seems unhinged, unable to just control his basic emotional state, and intellectually, you know, massively dishonest. And so I just don't know how, in the face of all of these things, you know, this is just the most recent iteration of many, many things on a daily, sometimes hourly basis. How can people say, well, you know, I was worried about the price of eggs, so this is okay. It's okay that this guy's in control of launching our nuclear weapons because I was worried about the price of eggs.
Yeah, and I think that it was very eye-opening. I just thought, wow, I don't know how that editorial panel threaded this needle, but they did, and they said it. And yet we look at what this president is saying, and he's saying that this was bad for America. Not that they didn't follow the Constitution or they didn't follow the law, but in his statements, Trump is really saying it doesn't matter what the law says. It matters what I say. And what I say is what's good for America. And that is what everybody should be getting in lockstep and following. And so they didn't say it quite that directly as I'm saying it, but that's where we are. That's what we have as a president. And then I think of all of the things that have happened, whether it's in Minneapolis, whether it's what we may or may not do in Iran, whether it's what's going on in Gaza, what's going on in Ukraine, all of these things, all of this chaos wrought by this president. And this is it, right? And I find that fascinating.
All right, we've heard from the panel. Now we hear from you. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we welcome your letters. We have a lot of them. We'll get to as many as we possibly can on the return. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. First, this break in news with Ray Graff.
I gave you 1,461 days. I gave you 4 years, chances to try.
Great stuff from Margot Price. Wild at Heart Tour coming to Bearsville Theater in Woodstock on the 26th of this month, BearsvilleTheater.com for more information. And you can check out the playlist posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. We've been talking about tariffs and the Supreme Court decision and President Trump's response. We welcome you, panel@WAMC.org. Here are some of the letters we have received. Harv writes, tariffs, when used surgically for actual national economic purposes, can be legal and work. But Trump uses them as an expression of personal and vindictive power. When he was confronted by Canada, Denmark, or China on something, he had a tantrum and raised their tariffs, which is not good. We go to John. Tariff money has been used to bail out farmers who lost their markets to China for soybeans and other farm products. The farmers are not expected to get that market back. So without the tariff money, what's going to keep the farmers afloat? Mark, what do you think about that?
Joe, I appreciate the acknowledgement that there have been receipts of tariffs, I think, in the $280, $300 billion range, and that some money has been used to offset some of the costs to some groups. But I think this goes back to the tax cuts for tariffs analogy, which I think falls short. We are still running a massive deficit in this country that's being funded by government borrowing, and no matter how we come out on Trump's tariffs, we will still be running a massive deficit. So I don't look at this as a trade of one thing for another specifically. Money's pretty fungible. I do think there's some thought that over the weekend, the reason Trump quickly went to 15% on his tariffs is they didn't want to see a big crowding effect at the ports when goods were coming in, because that would have led people to question the cost to Americans when they saw a whole bunch of people rushing to capitalize on lower tariff rates. And I also think there was some question about how the Treasury markets would respond to the fact that all of a sudden there'd be a $300 billion hole in the budget. But I think we should look at this as I think we should look broadly as this is a component of our budget and money is fungible. And unfortunately, we're relying on borrowing a tremendous amount of borrowing one way or the other.
But can I just push back on that a little bit as a question? Because as I see it, this revenue was not built into the big, beautiful bill or the big whatever we're calling it, because these tariffs were not approved by Congress. And so I believe that in Trump's mind, he is looking at this revenue as a little bit of a slush fund, right? We were going to deficit spend anyway. We didn't know how the hell we were going to pay for these tax cuts. And so he made promises to farmers. And I do think that he looked at this as kind of fun money for him. And maybe I'm wrong, but I think that that also is part of what he's factoring into his temper tantrum. In addition to the fact that he just didn't get his own way.
I can't tell you how Trump thinks about.
I would never ask you to do that.
right. So to the extent you're arguing Trump saw this as a slush fund, you may well be right. If you or I were in the Oval Office running the country, that wouldn't be the correct way to think about it. And particularly given the size of the U.S. deficit is so substantial. So I take your point on how Trump might have thought of this, but we still have a big hole in our budget that's being funded by debt. That's a question, no matter where these tariffs come out over the remainder of Trump's term, that's still a big question on the table. And the fact that Trump blew a larger hole in our budget with the ugly bill, big bill, is a substantial question that still hasn't been answered. And frankly, if the U.S. doesn't answer it by more fiscal discipline over time, the markets are going to answer it and instill that discipline for us, probably at an inopportune time, as we've seen throughout long-term and recent history in so many cases with other countries.
But, you know, I think you also have to, when you think about who's getting bailed out, and because these tariffs have a broad reach in terms of who's being affected, but then who's being bailed out also is a function of the upcoming midterm elections, the question of, you know, what seats are potentially in play, and the politics of who gets bailed out. And, you know, this administration, which I have, you know, a lot to criticize them on, but this is not the only administration that has played that kind of a game. And we have a long history of farmers being bailed out from one kind of thing after another because of the politics in those farm areas. And there are other industries also affected and other areas that are going to be bailed out and are being bailed out because of the politics. So this isn't just a function of the numbers, but it's, or at least the financial numbers, it's also a function of the electoral numbers.
Let's go back.
Can I just real quickly?
You sure can.
Just real quickly, if I may. Sorry, Joe. The Constitution clearly gave tariff power exclusively to Congress. Congress set rates directly for nearly 150 years. The problem was that the accumulation of log rolling or horse trading, whatever you want to call it, led to a horrible situation. You know, by the time we got to the Smoot-Hawley tariffs in 1930, and those tariffs clearly deepened the Great Depression. So that there was a reset starting in the 30s where Congress basically gave more of its power to the executive under the assumption that the executive wouldn't be bound by parochial concerns. And that state of affairs didn't work perfectly, as you mentioned, but it worked better than it had pre-1930 until Trump came along. And the slush fund I see is more of the political slush fund this guy uses, where he basically his every whim is reinforced by a tariff threat. And when we're done with him and the 3 years of legal wrangling that's going to persist, we're going to have to figure out as a country how we can better balance that tariff power and return more of it to Congress, but somehow insulate it from the parochialism that was so rampant in Congress and the whims that are so rampant in this executive office.
All right, let's go back to letters and see what else is on people's minds. We do welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. We get this from Barbara. Trump is going to litigate returning tariff money back to retailers. It was illegally levied against. What happens if he goes ahead and spends or dispenses that money before that's decided? What happens if a coming Democratic administration is charged with returning that money and it has already been spent? A question we will let hang in the ether unless somebody wants to grab hold
of it. Oh,
no,
there's an easy answer. We issue government debt and return the money. But let's just be clear. The money's going to go to importers who pay the taxes. I mean, they basically could push a button in a week or two. They know who paid the taxes when the stuff came across, metaphorically, came across the border. And they could reverse all those transactions within, frankly, days, if not even quicker than that. I don't disagree that the administration, out of spite or other interest, is going to litigate this to no end. But honestly, the unwinding of this and the paying for the unwinding is easy.
And if they don't refund that money, there is going to be a tsunami of lawsuits against the government by those importers who say, we want that money back.
Well, but it is, you know.
Got bad news for individuals. There's nothing in the law that would say you get this back just because you paid more for your, your outdoor chaise lounge and it was imported from China.
No.
That check is not coming.
But the retailers who paid the importer and the importer said,
right,
okay, the cost of your goods was $100, the cost of the tariff was $50, so here's your bill. They are expecting that $50 back. Not me, the consumer, who paid more for the chaise lounge, but there are small business owners who are looking at the bills that they paid for importing goods, and they want their money back.
Yeah, Kathy, this is advice I give to everyone when they come to me about financial disputes. Whoever got your money is the person, and you don't believe it's right that they have it because they haven't delivered, or in this case, you're due a refund. They're the one you go after. So it's a bit of a daisy chain here. The importers played the government, so they're going to sue the government. And the retailers and the importers are going to work it out. But I'd be shocked to see the courts, other than interpreting previously existing contracts between retailers and importers, I'd be surprised to see the courts step into that level of the daisy chain in any meaningful way.
All right, back.
That's all well and good.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, but that's all well and good. But who's going to pay the people? Who's going to pay back the folks who, because of this increase, are going to be evicted from their apartments? I mean, this, you know, we can talk at the highest levels all we want about the court and who's responsible and go after the person who has the money. But there are so many people who don't have the wherewithal to do that are being impacted by this. And, you know, we're just going down that road of poor houses again. And I have no doubt that if Trump and his ilk stay in office, we will see that in the United States of America.
Also, Mark, I guess this question directly to you, but anyone can answer it. But so under this 15% plan, a global tariff, which I understand has a shelf life of 5 months, I believe. So if that has somehow deemed to be illegal, then we just continue, right? I mean, we haven't like solved this problem yet.
Joe, I'm taking the over on this doesn't get solved until Trump is no longer president, because he's just going to leg. If one thing is
right,
found illegal, he's going to leg into another act and try to defend himself there. I want to say to Libby's point, by the way, and I've mentioned before, there's a commentator, Mike.
Job security for all of us. So that's great. We have plenty to commentate
yeah
on. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, Libby, I very much agree with your highlighting the fact that there are individuals and businesses that are going to be decimated by this. And I think it's always right when you talk about overall economic statistics to take a breath and look under the waves at some point. And I would point everybody to Michael Green and his recent analysis about affordability in this country. And I always use the analogy of the economist who sees the guy with his head in the oven and his foot in an ice block and says, well, on average, the guy's fine, just leave him alone. I do think we need to be careful when we talk about aggregate economic effects to look at the personal as well.
I also, Joe, to your point on the new version of the tariffs.
Yes.
One thing that I think is a key difference in the parts of the law that he's now using as a justification for this new round of tariffs is that these are specific to trade issues. So because he was declaring an emergency, a national emergency before, and he was using that emergency power, and he was saying it gave him broad powers to basically do any kind of tariff for any kind of reason. It could be a grievance. He could be upset about Greenland. He could be upset because Canada, the prime minister gave a speech that he didn't like, or whatever the reason, he could just do it under these emergency powers. Under the new sections of the law, I think it's 122 and 301, it has to be specifically justified via certain aspects of international trade. So he's a bit more limited in how he can justify it. Now, whether he actually follows that law and is constrained by it is another question, and I got the sense that Mark was saying that might not be the case, and you know that issue is not going to be solved in that way. But according to the law, that is the new kind of way forward with tariffs. It's not going to be as kind of wide-reaching and as you know grievance-based as it has been.
Let's see. We go to Wara. I love that Mark Whitman is referring to the big, beautiful bill as the ugly bill. I yell at the radio every time I hear it called that. Why repeat Trump's childish language? Then, in a switch, in a quick turnaround, Brian says, I'm a big fan of Mark, but his tariff argument falls short in a number of areas. Trump could easily reduce the deficit by spending less on defense, his pet programs and ego-driven spending on vanity projects costing the taxpayers billions. Would you like to reply to that, Mr. Whitman?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to clarify. Again, I think the country's fiscal situation is money fungible, and I think the letter writer is exactly correct that there are other ways we could start to solve our structural deficit. And if I didn't make that clear before, I should have, and I appreciate the letter writer.
Art writes, isn't it about 25th Amendment time? Can this insanity safely continue another 3 years? Can we gather the real military and do like Gerald Ford? This long national nightmare is over. That from R. on this Monday morning.
Well, when you surround yourself by cabinet members who are also inept, insane, and not willing to stand by anything that is defensible constitutionally or legally, it's hard to proceed that way. And I think Trump did a great job of making sure that that's exactly what he did.
John writes,
and not to mention Congress.
Right.
Let's not forget Congress and their spinelessness.
Not a lot of profiles and courage.
John writes, tariff money has been used to bail out farmers who lost their markets to China for soybeans and other farm products. The farmers are not expected to get that market back. So without the tariff money, what's going to keep? Did I read this already?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay, my apologies.
Yes.
So unless somebody wants to give a different brilliant answer, we'll just move on. Liz says, hi, panel. Could you explain how an emergency is legitimately declared and who's responsible for it, given the Youngstown concurrence you talked about?
Yeah, so I can't claim expertise on all that Justice Jackson laid out, but he did have kind of this three-step process and the three levels of analysis, as I recall from early this morning over my first cup of coffee. And I would just highly recommend that you and anyone who's interested go look that up. It's only 8 pages long. As I said, it's really wonderfully written. It's very accessible. It's not filled with a lot of legal jargon. And there is a kind of a specific framework that's laid out about, and it's overall, it's about the relationship between the legislative branch and the executive branch, but then it also gets into the specifics of how can we decide, you know, who decides and how is it decided, what is actually a justifiable emergency.
Jeff writes, perhaps some of the justices and Roberts have realized that giving Trump total immunity was not the best idea. No good man would want that power. No bad man should have it. The challenge will be taking down his autocratic decisions in piecemeal fashion, but that is where the court has brought us. Let's hope voters consider this issue more carefully next time. Then we go to this letter. Jeffrey Sachs has argued that Donald Trump's trade policies are, quote, delusional and based on a fundamental misunderstanding of economics. He asserted that in the U.S. trade deficit is caused by domestic overspending and government debt, not, quote, cheating by foreign partners, and that seeking bilateral trade balances with every country is logically impossible in a modern economy. He warned that these protectionist emergency decrees, quote unquote, act as a form of one person rule that destroys global wealth, suppresses innovation, particularly in green energy, and risks turning the U.S. into a rogue nation that ignores established international law and mutually beneficial trade. Here's my question. What does the panel think about this?
It's a good letter. I agree with the substance of that letter.
Anybody else want to take a pinata swipe at it? All right. We go to this, and it's from Stephen. As I understand it, one of the justifications for the tariffs is to encourage manufacturing return to the U.S. due to the higher cost of labor, construction, et cetera, in the U.S. manufactured products would cost consumers 2 to 3 times what they do now. Will people in the U.S. be happy paying much more for U.S. manufactured products just to feel happy that it will make America great, quote unquote, again, question mark?
And as I was saying before, also that the percentage of the overall economy that is manufacturing is much, much, much smaller than I think is being implied by Trump. And it's smaller not because of trade deficits, but for a wide variety of things that have changed in global economics over many, many decades. And there's, you know, no focus on the role of services in international trade, and that's really the name of the game for the United States right now. It's not manufacturing. I mean, that's got some level of importance, but that's the sole focus of this administration, and I think it's all part of this kind of, you know, hazy nostalgia of going back to time gone by when we'll make America great again by making it something that simply doesn't make any logical sense in our current times.
Two more letters and then we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll go into a lightning round to pick up a lot of the topics that we still have on our docket for this morning. Roger writes to us and says, Trump may feel the court justices are an embarrassment to their families. To everyone else, Trump is an embarrassment to the entire country. Then, finally, we go to Rob. Section 122 is not a blank check. None of the available statutory mechanisms are blank checks. They all have specific language that narrows either their scope or when they may be deployed. In our firm, Trade Attorneys, the thought is that the 122 tariffs are a stopgap for further action against Section 301, where the China tariffs come from, and 230. I hope you all know your. sections here.
I love the listeners.
Where the steel, aluminum, and auto tariffs come from? Please, please, I beseech you, keep track of this at home. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll wrap up with this wonderful group this morning. We'll do all of that after this short break. Still doing you. Never worked out. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. A few more moments with this wonderful group. And as I said, we're going to try to have a lightning round here with topics that I want to make sure we get to. First of all, if you woke up really, really, really early yesterday morning to maybe watch an Olympic hockey game, you would have heard that that it was announced by DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, that they were suspending TSA PreCheck. They announced that yesterday, very early yesterday morning, and said that because of the shutdown and because they're unable to do their jobs properly, they were going to shut it down. And then everybody got really mad. The airlines, hotels, the travelers, the corporations, the Democrats, the Republicans. And within 2 hours, lo and behold, they reversed course and said it would said that they would go back and it would remain operational with no change for the traveling public. As staffing constraints arise, TSA will evaluate on a case-by-case basis and adjust operations accordingly. I've read that line several times over the last 24 hours, and I don't know what it means. But I assume it's a opportunity that if they want to try this again, they can. But whether they would or not, given the way that it landed last time, I doubt it. A DHS official speaking on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal processes said the change was based off of conversations the secretary had with the White House and TSA. Oh, to be a fly on the wall for that. Anybody?
So I would just say that for my selfish purposes, I mean, PreCheck is one thing, but the thing that really saves me many, many hours is Global Entry. So that was also included in that initial... Yes. I'm stopping it. I don't know if that's going to be kicked back in. That's a great program.
My understanding that both programs were brought back.
Okay. All right.
That's my understanding.
Because it's all about me, after all.
No, like, I know.
How does
I
it
know.
Affect me? And I'm doing an international travel soon, and so I'd like, when you come back into the country and you can just glide right through with Global Entry, it really makes a huge difference.
It does, and I think to your point, you know, it is all about the individual, and this is, you know, somehow thinking that this would get the base riled up totally backfired. You know, this is an administration that has demonstrated its incompetence with respect to travel over and over again. The El Paso airport, this debacle, the video of Christine Noem talking about TSA pre and PreCheck and real ID and all of the BS and blaming the Democrats. I mean, it just shows they're just playing at this. These are not serious people. And, you know, I think it really backfired. And, you know, his people said, no, we don't really mean this. Don't do this. Play some other game to make the Democrats look bad. But God, don't let me not be in my TSA PreCheck line.
I have to say that I did admire the timing of it, because they were able to erase it prior to the Sunday morning talk shows. Like, they made the announcement, and then the response was very loud and very swift, and then they reversed course prior to the Sunday morning talk shows. And I thought, well, there you go. That's turning on a dime. Anybody else want to get in on that?
Well, just imagine, given what's going on right now with the snow, and all the flights that have been canceled, if they didn't reinstate, the lines would just be out the door, yeah. Let alone winding through the airport. And so, you know, it was a stupid thing to do. I don't think she really understands what she's doing. I think that's been proven over and over and over again. The only thing she does is, you know, I mean, she shot her dog because it wasn't acting right. So you can only imagine what we're dealing with here. But if they hadn't reversed this decision, the chaos at the airports now would be even worse.
We go to Mexico now and talk about the mayhem there. Mayhem that is rocking Mexico after the most wanted cartel boss was killed. El Mencho was the longtime head of one of the nation's most powerful cartels. Armed groups set fire to cars and buildings across Mexico in the wake of his death. The Mexican government said it had killed the nation's most wanted cartel boss, and that set off this wave of fires and violence across the country. El Mencho was the longtime leader of one of Mexico's most powerful cartels and was widely regarded as one of the country's most violent criminal figures. He presided over a criminal enterprise that has expanded rapidly over the past decade, producing and selling drugs, extorting local businesses, and terrorizing communities across the country. The killing then plunged Mexico into a highly tense moment that could unleash a surge in violence. Past captures of cartel leaders have set off wars between the government and cartels, as well as between opposing factions jockeying for power in the beheaded criminal group. Those fears were heightened on Sunday by a swift outbreak of violence across Mexico. In states around the country, armed groups blocked roads and set fire to supermarkets, banks, and vehicles in one of the most widespread eruptions of turmoil in the country's history. Anyone on that?
Well, I mean, it's frightening to see the news coming out of Mexico where people are being told to shelter in place. Tourists who are there and caught up in this are being told to stay in their hotels. Given the storm that's impacting the East Coast, anyone planning to travel here was going to be impacted by that anyway. But now it appears that airlines are canceling flights and that it is uncertain when people are going to be able to get out of the country from at least certain areas of Mexico. And so certainly, you know, to anyone who lives there and is living through this, it's got to be terrifying, as well as those who are visiting and uncertain when they're going to be able to get home and how they're going to be able to do that safely.
You know, I lived in a country that was beset by drug trafficking networks. And so I saw it firsthand how these organizations really get their tentacles deep into a society. It's not just that they are trafficking in drugs and engaged in that illegal behavior, but the ways in which they eat away at the sovereignty of the country in which they're existing, and that they have their own abilities to bring on large numbers of people to their side because they supply jobs, they supply safety, they supply all kinds of things that the state oftentimes cannot. And so when you see the Mexican government trying to push back against this cartel and other cartels, you know, this is a long-standing effort in Mexico. But many other states that are very weak states and have a limited ability to really push back and to not only enforce the law, but also to fill the vacuum of those things that people haven't otherwise been getting from the country for many decades. And it's a really tough struggle.
Anybody else? All right.
Joe, I would just add, this highlights some of the pressures that President Claudia Sheinbaum and her security minister, Omar Garcia Harfuch, face. They've had modest success reducing violence and the influence of gangs in Mexico. But now the president says she can reduce crime by, even though she's going to cut the budget for internal security to, I think it's about 1% of the budget where it had been double digits. The bet that she's making is you can hollow out what have been unreliable, if not corrupt, internal forces and use the military. But there's obviously critics who say that you can't rebuild. You eventually have to rebuild these hollowed out police forces and prosecutors. I mean, it's a long game here, right? Soldiers can secure highways and kick in doors, but they can't build criminal cases and reform courts and put in place the sort of durable civilian infrastructure that you need. The other cross current running against this is that the United States tends to like trophies, which are basically these decapitations, but that comes with it the effects that we're seeing in this case and doesn't necessarily lead to sort of the work that you need to do in terms of the long-term grind at the local level. So we'll see if Sheinbaum's new approach works and how adversely affected it is by the pressure that the United States places on her for pelts on the wall.
Finally, as we wrap up on this Monday morning, snowy Monday morning, the Olympics are over. After 3 weeks in Milan, the Winter Games have been completed. The next time Olympics take place, it will be in this country, in Los Angeles, California. I don't know. Was there anyone here who did not partake?
I watched the hockey games because I'm a huge hockey fan. So
yeah, well, yesterday was a good one. Yeah,
and the women, awesome as well.
Fantastic.
Although I will say the Canadian men played better, but the U.S. goalie, holy cow! This was a guy who his backstory was that his parents couldn't afford for him to play like elite travel hockey, and he went to I think UMass Lowell, and he won the Olympics for that team. I mean, he stopped, I forget how, 40-plus goals, and he was on fire. It was a really exciting game.
I think it's unfortunate and really unacceptable that the president of the United States, when he called the men's team to congratulate them, also took a swipe at the women's team.
Yeah.
And he said that he wanted to invite the men to the White House, and he said, well, I'm probably going to have to invite the women, too. Otherwise, I'd be impeached. What is wrong? What in
the
world?
He's a pig. He hates women. I mean, come on. This should not be surprising to any of us.
Yeah,
right.
And I don't want to drag him into this. I want to, I think we saw athletes do amazing things. The U.S. won the most gold medals in a winter game than I think it ever has. But just, I saw a lot of really enthusiastic, great athletes. I felt like it was a place of refuge because I wasn't hearing about politics. I was just watching people who are passionate about what they do. And so I just want to bask in that. I need something. Just please give it to me. Don't ruin it in the last 4 minutes.
No. My dear wife asked me last night, she said, what was your favorite moment at the Olympics? And I said, the Norwegian skier who lost and then just decided to take off and go into the woods. I love that. I would just be so happy just like going off and laying in the woods. And he was complaining because I guess police and photographers and everybody came there to get him back. And he's like, just leave me alone. Just leave me alone for 10 minutes.
But and who could have counted on F-bombs from the Canadian team in curling?
Yes, in curling, and then Michaela Schifrin on the Today Show with an F-bomb. There were some good moments, and good stuff. Mark, anything you want to add?
We too watched the hockey. It was brilliant, and a goalie, by the way, was shades of Jim Craig, which just. The whole thing highlighted how much fun sport can be. But as I highlighted to my family, that was great sport. In the 80s, it was great politics. I was happy as the mayor states not to deal with politics yesterday morning. It was a lot of fun.
It was certainly a very, you know, it's like you're invested in this, and then it's over, and you're like, oh, now what? I didn't do it all. I don't have anything to watch at 2 o'clock in the morning now. What am I going to do?
Now into baseball.
Yeah, now into that's right. That's exactly what I did yesterday afternoon. All right. My thanks to everyone. What a great group. Mark Whitman, Libby Post, Kathy Sheehan, thank you very much. Jim Ketter, you're going into extra innings.
Apparently so.
All right. We'll be back and explain that right after this.